Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I'm your host, John Hansen, and this is the show where we talk to the bodybuilding legends, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. And on today's show, we've got a really good interview with Ken Sprague. And if you know bodybuilding history at all, I'm sure you know the name Ken Sprague. Ken was one of the most prominent owners of Gold's Gym. Of course, Gold's Gym was started by Joe Gold back in the 1960s, I think 1965. But then Joe, after only a couple of years, decided to sell the gym to Bud Danzig, who was actually from Chicago. And then Ken Sprague bought the gym from Bud because this gym was not profitable at all. I think they only had like 40, 45 members, if you can believe it or not, one of the most iconic gyms in bodybuilding history. But then Ken Sprague really promoted the gym. He was a really good expert in promotion and marketing, and he had a lot of contacts in the film industry and the television industry out in California. So Ken had the gym right when Pumping Iron was being filmed in 1975. And so then when Pumping Iron was released in 1977, the popularity of Gold's Gym really took off, as we're going to hear from Ken. And then Ken also got into promoting competitions as also a way of promoting Gold's Gym. And he promoted the 1976 AAU Mr. California. And then he promoted the 1977 AAU Mr. America, which was one of the biggest contest promotions in history. He had movie stars at that event. He actually had a parade that preceded the contest, which was unbelievable. I've never heard of that before or since. And then after that, Ken actually started promoting some of the first professional bodybuilding shows, including the 1978 Gold's Classic, which Robbie Robinson mentioned a little bit a couple weeks ago when we did the interview with Robbie, because Robbie won that contest, and he also won a 1978 Cadillac Seville. So we got a really, really interesting interview with Ken Sprague, who's going to talk about the history of Gold's Gym and also contest promotion and what he did to really help promote the sport of bodybuilding in the late 1970s in the golden era. All right, I want to mention off the bat that we are brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs. And I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning Fat Burner Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion and the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia, Samir Banute, bodybuilding legend Tom Platz, and the real deal, Chris Cormier. So use the discount code LEGENDS12, and you will get 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. Right. In other news, they had a big contest over the weekend, the Arnold Classic Australia, and it was pretty interesting. I got to watch it live online. I believe it was yesterday morning, and William Bonick was the winner, and William was second to Brandon Curry a couple weeks ago when the Arnold Classic was held in Columbus, Ohio. So William looked amazing. I mean, this guy is just so thick and so dense. It's hard to beat this guy. He's a little shorter, and he's not as wide as a lot of the competitors. His structure is a little limiting, but the amount of muscle and the density and the thickness he portrays is just unbelievable. Now, a very close second place was Cedric McMillan, which I was really happy to see. Cedric was only fourth at the Arnold Classic in Columbus because he was pretty much off. He was really off as far as conditioning goes. But he really dialed it in over the last 2 weeks, and he looked really, really good. It was really close. It was just two different types of physiques. Cedric, of course, is much taller. He's much wider. I think he's got one of the best physiques in pro bodybuilding. If I would have been a judge, I probably would have picked Cedric to win just because of his structure and overall shape. But it's hard to deny William Bonick the win because the guy was just so thick. He was very, very impressive. But Cedric had him beat on a lot of the poses, especially the front double bicep, the lat spread. His rear double bicep was incredible. I mean, he really dialed it in. Let's see, who else was in there? Third place was Raleigh Winkler, who also really came in much, much better shape than he was 2 weeks ago in Columbus. He was way off there, but he looked much better here. Really hard, really thick. He won a lot of the poses. It was really close between those three. Joshua Lenardowicz, who is from Australia, also came in much better shape, and he moved up to fourth place. He was out of the top six in Columbus. And then Luke Sandow, who did great in Columbus, he was a surprising third for somebody pretty new to the pro scene. He really established himself in Columbus, but he dropped down to fifth here. So, of course, it's hard to hold your conditioning for a couple of weeks, especially when you're traveling to the other side of the world. Really good contest. And I also want to mention my friend Jessica Reyes Padilla, who is from Puerto Rico. And Jessica won the Arnold Classic Australia, so she's got to be overjoyed. She's won some pro shows before, but never an Arnold Classic. And I think she was in third place at the Arnold Classic in Columbus a couple of weeks ago, and she was fourth at the Olympia last year. So she's really doing good, and this was not even close. She definitely dominated this field, so congratulations to her. I know she got interviewed by Arnold. I was looking for that interview online, but I couldn't find it. So I'm sure she was overjoyed, and she's got to be happy. This has got to be the highlight of her career. I saw Jessica first compete back in 2014 out here in Tampa at Tim Gardner's show, and that was one of her first shows ever. And you could see she had the potential. So to watch her progress from the last 5 years is just amazing. She's really gone to the top of the sport. All right. My interview last week with Glenn Kinnear was very well received, I'm happy to say. So I'm going to read some of the emails we got from that. I got a lot of comments on Facebook, of course, as I always do. Some people just commented on the picture I put of Glenn, but some people actually did listen to the interview. My good friend Dennis Durkin, one of my best friends from Chicago, he knew Glenn as well as I did when we were growing up. So Dennis said, "Awesome, John. What storied memories and what a good guy Glenn was and still is." So that was great to hear. Dennis, I'm glad he got to listen to the interview. I knew he would love it. John Defendis said, "It was a great photo of a great champion and friend, great physique." Terry Newsom, another good friend of mine from Chicago, said, "Blast from the past." Doug Brignoli said, "Great interview, John and Glenn. Good job and excellent memories." George Frazier, another old friend of mine from Chicago, who was a great competitor in the teenage ranks. George said, "Awesome." And then I got to hear from another great guy from Chicago, a really good competitor, Larry Bernstein. Larry was another one of these guys like Glenn that I looked up to when I was competing as a teenager. Larry was a shorter guy, but very thick, very complete. He was a dominating force in Chicago, and then he went on to the national level, and I believe he won his class in the short class at the Mr. America the year Jeff King won the Mr. America. So Larry was a really, really great bodybuilder. There was a couple guys that I really looked up to, like Larry, another guy, John Gust, who won a lot of titles, and I actually trained with John in 1986, and of course, Glenn. So great to hear from Larry. I haven't heard from him in probably 20 years. I really didn't know him as well as Glenn. So it was great to hear him. He commented and he said, "Glenn, congrats. Nice to see. I remember seeing you on my first teenage show. You were ahead of the field back then, especially your legs and abs. Go Illinois." And then my friend Joe Mullen said, "Larry, I was young, but I remember you from the old quads gym in Thornton." Lance Dreyer made a comment and he said, "Glenn was a great champ. Ask him who helped him get that chiseled look." And Glenn responded, "Lance, I can't thank you enough, my friend." And Larry responded to Joe McMullins, and he said, "Joe, was that not the best training environment? Tommy and Dave ran such a hardcore facility at Quad's Gym that is just not duplicated anymore. I hope you're doing well." And Joe said, "Hi, Larry. Yes, it was absolutely the best. I'm doing well, thanks." And then Larry said again, "John Hansen, thanks, John. I miss those hardcore environments like Quad's and Hammers. Those were the unique and rarely replicated. Man, did they get some results." So, yeah, that was just a great time talking to Glenn last week. We really relived a lot of memories from Chicago from me growing up. So it was really, really cool to listen to that and get to talk to Glenn again. I felt like I was 30 years ago, you know, we were in the old days when I was a teenager. So it was really great. Let's see. We got some emails also about the interview and about other subjects. This one was from Jay Smith. And Jay said, "I am a librarian at the San Carlos Library in California. A patron has three questions that I've had no success answering. Here are the questions as he wrote them. One, who sells a Night of the Champions bodybuilding contest on video for 1978, 1979, and 1980. I am not aware of a video from the Night of the Champions. Those were all three great contests. I believe the first two were won by Robbie Robinson. In 1980, it was won by Chris Dickerson. Actually, no, they didn't have a Night of the Champions in 1980. I think that was the only year they didn't have a Night of the Champions contest. I don't think anybody took any videos from either of those years. I know in the 1980s, there was a couple of companies that were videotaping it. Like I have the video from 87 when Gary Stridham won and Mike Ashley took second. So I know the couple of those shows were filmed, but I don't think anybody filmed the first three Night of the Champions. Question number two, he said, is there a website, street address, or email to contact Kevin M. Horton? He was the producer and director of the Dorian Yates bodybuilding video, Blood and Guts. I don't know that. I could ask Peter McGuff, because Peter, I'm sure, was friends with Kevin Horton, because they both lived in England at the time. Actually, Peter was not living in England at the time, but I'm sure he knows Kevin pretty good, so I could ask him. And then question number three, who sells the 1980 Mr. Olympia contest video? The contest footage not shown on TV that was talked about by Boyer Coe on your show. Well, that footage was filmed by CBS Television, and they never aired it. And as far as I know, there's no way to get a hold of that footage. I would love to see that footage, because Boyer said it really showed that Arnold was not the winner. So that would be really interesting to see. But as far as I know, the only ones who saw that footage was Boyer, Chris Dickerson, Dennis Tenorino, and he said a couple other people in the screening room when they showed that. Wayne Galash from Australia at gmvproductions.com.au, because he's in Australia. Wayne has a really good contest footage of the 1980 Mr. Olympia, so you could buy that. There is a video called The Comeback that was filmed by the promoter of the contest, Paul Graham. So you can look for that. I'm sure that's on eBay or Amazon.com. It's called The Comeback. And then I really saw some really good footage from a guy named Norm Comich. And Norm passed away. But when he was still alive, he was selling this footage. He was selling it on, I believe it was one of the websites I used to go on. I think it was the one that Sean Perrine created. But I got a hold of this video, and I have it. And Norm was sitting in the balcony at the 1980 Mr. Olympia, and he took this contest footage, and it was really, really good. It showed all the guys looked great, but you really could see Arnold's legs looking really thin. And maybe it was just the angle that Norm was filming it from, but I could see from looking at Norm's video why this contest was so controversial, because you could really see Arnold's legs were way off, and a lot of the other guys, like Dickerson, Zane, even Menser, Boyer, they all looked really good. They were all in contest condition. So if you can get a hold of that, that's really good. But as far as the one you're talking about, the one from CBS Television, yeah, I don't know anybody who's seen that except, like I said, those few guys, and that is not available. All right, I got another really good email from a guy named Ben Smith, and Ben said, John, your Bodybuilding Legends podcast is fantastic. When I turn on your podcast while driving to work, I am transported to Gold's Gym in the early 70s. I am wearing that old yellow Gold's Gym tank top and working out alongside the legends of the sport. I can see Tom Platt squatting in the corner until he passes out, then jolts back up and prepares himself under the bar again. I look over to see Arnold straining to finish off his pecs by doing flies on the flat bench. Frank Zane and Ed Corney are in front of the mirror, fine-tuning their newest poses for each other. It is through your great interviewing and your distinguished guests' detailed stories that this sensation is possible. I enjoy learning about the legends that we all know of, like those listed before, but I believe the true gem of your show is that you are interviewing people that the younger generation, like myself, will not find in their latest issues of today's muscle and fitness. Your show is preserving a special time in the sport of bodybuilding through the eyes of the people who lived it. A few ideas for upcoming podcasts that I haven't heard anyone else mention yet. A series based on training styles. For example, 3-day full body, like that of Steve Reeves, Reg Park, etc. Double splits like Arnold, or HIT training like Mike Menser and Dorian. Dieting, high carb versus low carb. The golden era bodybuilders were extremely good peaking and coming to shows in great conditioning, which seems to be lacking most times today. And an Arnold Classic series, just like the Olympia series, detailing the events leading up to and the contest itself. Thanks for taking the time to read this. You are a true inspiration. Keep up the great work. And then Ben also sent me another email, and he said, I forgot to add this to my earlier email. Another suggestion for a future podcast would be to have a series on the guys who graced the most magazine covers. Since the magazines were such a huge inspiration until just recently with YouTube and the internet, I thought this would be a great insight into the golden era. It would be great to see Michael Hearn on the podcast. Thanks again, Ben Smith. All right, Ben, thank you very much. That was a really great email. And I got one from Jim Kerr. And Jim says, I really enjoyed your interview with Glenn Kinnear. You mentioned Ron Tufel, and Glenn wondered how Ron was doing. It's my understanding that Ron Tufel died in 2002. You also mentioned Mario Nieves. He was also an excellent bodybuilder that would be a worthy subject for an interview. I think Glenn was talking about Tim Belknap, not Ron Tufel, because Glenn competed against Tim Belknap. I don't think he mentioned Ron Tufel because he never competed with him. And then I got an email from Larry Bernstein, who, as I mentioned, was a great champion in Chicago. And Larry said, John, first time catching your podcast. It was awesome listening to you and Glenn converse about the old hardcore gyms back in the day. A lot of the names you discussed, I had competed with, and it brought back great memories. I'm still in touch with Dave DeYoung and Lance Dreyer. Dave DeYoung was the owner of Quad's Gym in Chicago. And Larry says, I actually beat Glenn at the 1979 Mr. Teenage Illinois, and I was sure it was going to him. I love our Illinois bodybuilders. The bit with Belknap, I could certainly relate. Thanks for the great work, Larry. And then I got another really good email from Mark Martinez, who was on our show a couple weeks ago, and I wanted to read this because this was really good. He said, hi, John. I'm looking forward to hearing the Ken Sprague podcast when posted. He said, I will listen to Glenn Kinnear's interview soon. On a personal observation on Tim Belknap, it usually pops into my head when people talk about when bodybuilding went off the rails in terms of insulin and bubble guts and whatnot. Anyway, 1980 World's Gym, I just finished working out with Joe Fuster, and we're talking to Eddie Giuliani and Zabel Kwasuski at the little desk or cubicle area that was near the front stairs that led you from the gym down to Main Street. Up the steps comes Tim Belknap, tank top and Gold's Gym gym shorts. Huge and veiny, and his face looked round and red. It looked like his head was inflated to about 400 PSI. He walks in, and he's eating a Yoplait yogurt with his fingers. He just waddles around and says nothing. A girl that looked to be about 14 years old was trailing behind him. He slowly gives the inside of Worlds a once-over. He ignores Eddie G's greeting, and then he leaves. Aside from the fact that I'd never seen so much muscle packed onto a 5-foot-5-inch frame, it didn't look good, not like Danny Padilla or Franco. It just looked different. Of course, it was the insulin. I know Tim was diabetic, so one of the biggest changes in bodybuilding may have been discovered on accident. But once others learned what insulin could do, the genie could never be put back in the bottle. Wow, that was a great story, Mark. Thanks for sharing that. And then for some reason, I got a lot of comments about the video I put up about Boyer Co. talking about the 1980 Mr. Olympia. Nelson Montana says, to everybody who says it was rigged for Arnold, that means you believe Chris Dickerson should have won since he came in second. And honestly, even though Arnold wasn't at his best, is it so hard to believe that a guy 6'2" beat a guy 5'6"? Jack Price said, they always go back to Arnold not being as big as before and looking nervous backstage. The Zane people won't admit that he was off. The Dickerson people won't admit that Arnold dwarfed him in a front double, side chest, rear double, and most muscular. Look at the judges' point system versus the placement system. Not one guy consistently placed at number one. Arnold used everything, every trick, and psychology to win. Swolis Ferrari says, Arnold blew those MFs away. He had more size and muscle and was more ripped than any of the other people. Being down and smaller, he was still better than the other competitors. And then MDD 1963 says, horseshit. Look at the photos that ran in Muscle and Fitness. Might have been Muscle Builder back then. Graham said, I'm hoping that someone who has seen this film might be an anorak. In the UK, that's what we call a person with a fanatical interest in a subject. I hope that someone is so interested in Chris Dickerson that they have kept fastidious records of his career. In May or June of 1981, I attended a talk given by him at the Conway Hall in London, UK. For reasons which would take too long to explain, I'm trying to discover the exact date. Can anyone help? All right, I don't know that, but maybe someone does. Gert Jan Boot says, Mr. Olympia 1980 and 81 were totally rigged. Just another proof that a judge sport like bodybuilding is not a real competition sport at all. Brian Semple said, Boyer Co. is a true gentleman, articulate, intelligent, with a beautifully balanced physique and the ability to present it perfectly. I was lucky to have a seat beside him at one of the Night of the Champions show. and I really enjoyed his commentary and his opinions of the competitors. Loho says, great podcast, great golden era stories. I enjoyed it a lot. The stories are as legendary as the physiques back then. By the way, Jerry, get the fuck out of my face. He's talking about Jerry Branham. And XXYY says, I agree. Arnold did not have the proportions to win the Olympia title. Mike was better. So that was some comments about the Boyerville video that was on YouTube. So we got a lot of comments. Of course, the 1980 Olympias continues to be one of the most talked about Mr. Olympias ever. All right. So I also want to mention, before we get to our interview with Ken Sprague, that we are brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number, which is 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's FL for Florida, alternativemeds.com. And if you mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, they will not only give you a free consultation, but they will also give you 20% off your order. And you should also ask them about their new product, which is called the Magic Pill. It is developed and backed by science. It's a formula that was made by chemists and expert formulators who are working with Florida Alternative Medicine. This is a revolutionary fat-burning product, and it's getting rave reviews from athletes all over the country. So if you want to order a month's supply of this amazing fat loss pill and thermogenic, the price is $39.99. And just call them again at 813-922-8939 and order theirs. And maybe they'll give you a deal on it if you tell them you heard about it from the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. It's called the Magic Pill. So check that out. And Florida Alternative Medicine will work with anyone in the United States, in the continental United States. You don't have to be in Florida. So they will work with you over the phone or by the internet. All right. So that is our opening. And here is our interview with Ken Sprague, one of the legendary owners of Gold's Gym during the late 1970s. You're really going to love this interview. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And we have a very special guest on the line with us today. His name is Ken Sprague. And Ken was very instrumental in bodybuilding in the late 1970s during the golden era. He was the owner of Gold's Gym. He bought it from Joe Gold in the 1970s and actually owned it during the filming of Pumping Iron. And he also promoted some really big competitions, including the very famous 1977 AAU Mr. America contest, which was one of the most famously promoted contests in the history of the sport. So it's great to have you on the line, Ken.
Thanks, John. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Well, why don't we start at the very beginning, as we always do, Ken, and tell us how you got into bodybuilding, a little bit about your background.
Sure. I got into bodybuilding from an older brother who I think I was around 10 years old, and he took me to the YMCA and picked up weights, and literally from that time on, I enjoyed weightlifting, got into bodybuilding when the guys at the local YMCA goaded me into entering the Mr. Cincinnati contest, my hometown, Cincinnati. And that went well. Eventually, I guess I was 24 years old, I thought, well, Cincinnati's not for me. So I took a drive out to California, and wouldn't you know it, where I got an apartment on the beach. It was, maybe a block away from the original Gold's Gym.
Okay.
And that's what got me involved with bodybuilding and with Gold's Gym. I remember the first time I went into the gym, I snuck in. I had a friend who also lived at the beach, and he says, hey, let's go over to Gold's. I had never really heard of Gold's. I had heard of Vince's. I heard of Pearl's. They were the two biggest gyms at the time. And Szabo Kaczewski, I'm sure you know that name.
Yeah.
Anyway, Szabo was the manager of Gold's at the time for Joe Gold. And he would always leave for a few hours around lunchtime. My buddy knew this. And so we snuck to the gym and got a good workout. And Szabo and Joe were none the wiser.
So what was it like the first time you went to Gold's Gym?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, the real aura developed at different hours of the day. When we snuck in, tough to remember, but if there were two people, that's an overstatement.
Wow.
It was very poorly attended. I suspect the gym at that time had maybe 40 members.
Mm-hmm.
And wow. Most of the guys would either come in early and train or late and train.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, lay out on the beach or go to the Germans and eat. But nobody was there midday. That gave us our opportunity.
So you were living in California then. What were you doing for a living out there, Ken?
Well, I got involved in a production company for commercials. I guess some of your listeners might remember commercials like Parquet Margarine, butter. You have this mm-hmm. little... Anyway, I produced those.
Okay.
Got into some other kind of films, which I don't broadcast much, but...
Okay.
But a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I started making money, and when Gold's came up for sale, nobody else wanted to buy it. It was a losing proposition.
Yeah.
And gyms, I guess, generally, especially bodybuilding gyms, maybe, which there weren't many, but... They were losing propositions, and I bought it candidly because I was training there. Now, this was 1972. I'd been in California for 3 years, and I trained off and on at Gold's a mm-hmm. good bit. Really liked training there, and I didn't want to disrupt my life because I lived at the beach. I had a house at the beach,
mm-hmm.
and I got into ownership of Gold's that purely.
Wow.
I thought, well, gosh, I probably won't lose too much money if I can just float the cash flow. Everything mm-hmm. will be all right. And with the gym, of course, came some real estate. And the real estate in Venice, California really took off. I managed to buy the gym, the building, the house next door, a lot next door to that, all as one package when I bought the
gym.
Oh,
wow. Okay. Huh. So Joe Gold just basically wanted to get out of it because...
Well, now there was an intermediary. Joe Gold, of course, opened the gym, and I think that was 65, 66,
mm-hmm.
and he couldn't make a dime. And then this fellow named Bud Danitz came out from Chicago, and he thought, gosh, I'll buy the gym. And he was an antique dealer, and he got into problems financially. He had a big load of antiques on the boat or waiting at the dock, and he didn't have the money, and he needed, now this is going to knock your socks off, but all it cost me to go in to buy the gym, the business, the building next door, and the lot next door to that, a block away from the ocean outside of Los Angeles, all I had put up was $15,000 down.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah, exactly. It is unbelievable. But at that time, you know, at that time, Gold's is such a famous place, and it became a famous place after I bought it in the 70s. But it had not been mentioned in one national publication other than an occasional mention in Weider's magazine, and I think once or twice in the other magazines.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as mainstream media, like newspapers and TV spots, it was totally unknown. Not one spot in all that time.
And bodybuilding was pretty much unknown at that time, too, also.
Oh, yeah. It was tough rounding up enough to have a contest. My mm-hmm. first contest promotion. I did it. I felt I had to do it. Incidentally, Ken Waller gets a lot of credit because I wouldn't have bought the gym had it not been for Waller agreeing to manage it for me. We had known one another back in Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah. And, okay.
Yeah. In fact, I judged him. I was a judge for the Mr. Midwest contest, which he won in the late 70s. Or, I'm sorry, late 60s.
Okay.
And we got to know one another. He was from Kentucky at that time. And I said, Ken, you know, you manage a gym and I'll buy it. Again, figuring I wouldn't lose too much money on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Ken agreed. And he was a manager for a couple of years. And that was that. But I think I was about to talk about that first contest promotion.
Yeah.
I thought just because the guys, you know, needed contests, that I'd hold the Mr. Western America contest, the IFBB Mr. Western America. I had no idea about the political organizations.
Okay, yeah.
But I said, I asked Joe. I said, Joe, how about Joe Weider? I said, how about if I go ahead and put on the Mr. Western America? Well, I did. I put it at a famous comedy club on Sunset Strip, Zero's. And I had a tough time drumming up, I think there were six competitors. And this is going to give you a sense. You mentioned bodybuilding at the time. It wasn't that big a deal. I paid Arnold Schwarzenegger, of course. I paid Arnold and I paid Ken Waller as guest posers for this event. We only drew maybe 50 spectators. Of course, that was, you know, that was a novice promoter at that time. We drew maybe 50 spectators, but Arnold and Waller, out of the goodness of my heart, I gave him $50 each to guest pose.
Wow.
So time did. They changed.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because you said you didn't know anything about the different organizations and stuff, because the AAU was the big amateur competition back then. That was the only. Well, I remember I started competing in
and
the 70s.
And that was, you see, with Weider, he was at the gym frequently. And we were called an IFBB gym at that time. In fact, the AAU didn't want me to ever promote an AAU contest because of association with Gold's Gym. They referred to it as that really wasn't the reason. They wanted to hold on to the contest for themselves, the local AAU group, because the bodybuilding shows, for example, like Mr. Los Angeles and Mr. California, and occasionally a Mr. America show would be sponsored by the Southern California group of weightlifters. They wanted the revenue from the bodybuilding shows to support weightlifting.
Okay.
So they would say, oh, that Gold's Gym, you know, that's an IFBB gym, a professional gym, whatever that means. And they tried to block me from holding contests. So.
Yeah, but if you're going back to 72, I mean, that's before the MPC started. So it was just AAU and then the IFBB, right? And they were totally separate entities.
Oh, yeah. You know, well, there wasn't any real IFBB shows. You know, there were in New York. And occasionally, there would be one, like there hadn't been one. Frank Zane had done the Mr. Western America also a few years earlier. But there really weren't any IFBB-affiliated contests out on the West Coast or anywhere across the country, you know, except in New York. And it was all sort of an illusion for Joe.
Right,
Smith.
Right. So when you bought the gym, Ken, how did you start to turn it around as far as getting more people in there back in 1972?
Well, I had contacts in the motion picture industry.
Okay.
And I thought that, well, gosh, if a producer wants to do a shot in a gym, I'd say, hey, come on down to the gym. All you have to do, your people, if they're doing a gym scene, is wear a Gold's Gym t-shirt. And that got me more publicity than I could have ever afforded to purchase.
Yeah.
You know, there are different movies, different TV shows, and then the shirts would wind up, Roseanne Barr even wore one at the Super Bowl. The Hawk would wear them on his trips around the world. And, of course, seeing them in a film like Pumping Iron, too. Those were all printed for Pumping Iron.
Oh, okay.
But it just established that name worldwide beyond this little storefront gym in Venice, California. There's an interesting story, too, about that T-shirt. Waller said, hey, let's have half a dozen T-shirts made. And I thought, gosh, nobody's going to want a Gold's Gym T-shirt. But I said, okay, go ahead and do it. So he got Rick Drayson to do a little sketch. Waller designed the T-shirt. He said, go ahead and make the man look like the man, the ball-headed guy on the Mr. Clean detergent box.
Right.
And just have a bent bar, holding a bent bar. So Drayson went ahead and sketched it out. And that shirt went on before too long to be the top-selling brand shirt in the country.
It was Waller's idea what to put on the shirt, huh?
Exactly. It was all Waller's idea. And me, if it were me, again, I bought the gym primarily for a hobby.
Yeah.
And I never had any thoughts about making any money out of it when I bought it. And I thought, gosh, let's just make it a place to train. And Waller said, oh, we, you know, make some money off of a few shirts. No one ever anticipated where Gold's would go. Well, let me put it like this. I never anticipated how big it could be. Mm-hmm. But then I, started promoting other shows, and I saw how easy it was to get news media in the gym and at the shows. For example, you mentioned the 77 Mr. America contest. Mm-hmm. That contest had more press requests than that year's Academy Awards.
Wow.
And we made it on 60 Minutes, the cover of the Wall Street Journal. I think there were, well, Mae West handed out the trophy. Some of your younger listeners might not know that name. But
yeah, at the time, she was a screen icon, yeah.
Oh, yeah, she was an icon, and she had not made an announced public appearance in a number of years. She was just getting old.
Yeah.
And I managed to talk her into making a public appearance. So that brought out all the old Hollywood types, which made it even a bigger promotion.
Wow. And,
so, you know, one thing led to another, but Gold's was essentially at that time a promotional organization.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the t-shirt. I was just watching the documentary about Studio 54 on Netflix the other day, and they were showing all these old pictures, you know, from when the disco was going on back in the 70s, and one of the girls in there had a Gold's Gym t-shirt on, so it was pretty funny. It shows you, oh, that thing was getting around, you know?
Oh, it was getting around. Yeah, it was getting around.
So tell me how George Butler and Charles Gaines approached you about making the movie Pumping Iron in 1975.
Okay, well, before that, of course, they came in for the book.
Okay.
And anybody that wanted to come in there and take a shot, or a shot meaning photograph, or write a piece in the paper or write a book, it was open season. I had no restrictions whatsoever. Just come on in and go ahead and mm-hmm. do it. Happy to have you. So Pumping Iron, the book, came out. And then, of course, Butler came back with the movie. And again, this is worth putting into context. I had a experience in the motion picture industry. I knew what a producer and a photographer, a director needed to get the best possible product on film. And I told Butler, hey, why don't you go ahead and just string your lights? Gold's had high ceilings, 16-foot ceilings. I said, just go ahead and mount your lights permanently. And when you come into film, just flip them on, and you're all set. Now, he had planned to film at Vince's and Pearl's, but once he got the idea how easy it was going to be for him to film at Gold's, that made Gold's the primary location. So there's all these little nuances to make it happen.
Yeah. But,
and again, free. Sure, George, go ahead and do it. I knew there was publicity on the other end for Gold's. And I'll be candid with you. I never felt Pumping Iron would be any kind of movie. But I thought, no, the public will never buy this. But there
right.
again, you know,
yeah.
You can
yeah.
be wrong and things come out okay.
Yeah. Well, I remember when it first was released in January of 77, I went and saw it as a 14-year-old. And
yeah.
it was at some little art house in Chicago. And I think there was like 15 people in there, and I don't think it lasted more than a couple of weeks in the theater before it went away. And
sure.
then it just caught on later on, you know?
You, didn't it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it kind of solidified the name. And that was a film that got more PR in the general media than was reflected by the number of people that saw it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, again, PR is so important anytime you're trying to, you know, build brand and free PR particularly.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you had a background in the movie industry. So you were able to help them out with the lighting and see the problems that they might've had making a film, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I had blocked the windows too. The Gold's had these great windows on the, on Pacific Avenue on the street. We'd get bounce from the buildings across the street, light through the front windows, and it was great for black and white photography. Like Artie Zeller at the time was the fundamental or prime photographer for Weider. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was great for him because he only shot black and white. But for motion pictures, you know, and especially for a documentary where you wanted to catch the guys in action rather than set up a scene, you'd often be hampered, or you would be hampered by any kind of lighting situation like that. You could never shoot into it, et cetera.
Yeah.
And, fortuitously, I had blocked off those windows. So what that did was provide with Butler's lights up on the ceiling, just the perfect ability to spontaneously shoot. It could catch mm-hmm. anybody anywhere in the gym at a second's notice.
Hmm. Wow, that's great. Now, how long were they in there, Ken? How many months were they in there?
You know, it wasn't a matter of what he'd do is come and go. Like, he'd go ahead and shoot for a couple days, and then he'd be out at the beach maybe, try something else. He'd go to a restaurant and film. But I would think total, his shooting schedule could not have been more than 2 weeks total, include everything in California.
Huh. That's crazy.
But he shot a lot of film. I think he shot 100 hours of film.
Yeah, that's what I read too. So did they know what they were going to shoot, or were they just kind of improvising?
Improvising. They were improvising. They knew when they hit the, for them, they hit the jackpot that, you know, Golds was so available to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think they knew what they were going to, well, they didn't know the exact scene, but they knew they were going to do a lot of shooting in there. And of course, all the guys came, like Corny from San Francisco, you had Arnold, you had Franco and the whole crew in their training for the show, or for the movie, and for the upcoming show. So that was taken care of. But now they did put in some extra scenes later. That's why it couldn't be a true documentary. I mean, Waller hiding the T-shirt, that was one.
Mm-hmm.
And the two throwing a football, that was done afterward.
Right.
Callard, yeah. But no, he really, I think he had the intent of shooting it as a documentary.
Okay.
But he felt that he had to add a couple of manufactured scenes when it got right down to it.
Ken, I wanted to ask you about those train drawings on the wall. I've always wondered about that. When I saw the book Pumping Iron, I was like, what is that? You know, they had these, you know, these conceptual train drawings of the inside of a train.
Yeah.
What was that all about?
Those were the undercarriage of a train. And the fellow from Chicago, Bud Danitz, the antique dealer, when he bought the place, mm-hmm. he thought, well, we got to really doctor this place up. He had these delusions of grandeur. This is going to be a great federal health, you know, facility sort of gym. So he had these undercarriage drawings from his antique business. So he just plastered them up on the wall.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was it.
Wow. I always wonder where that came from. I always wanted to ask somebody that.
Yeah, it's all these little connections here and there. In this case, the antique dealer throws his, you know, his drawing on the wall.
So you mentioned Ken Waller, and it sounded like you had a good relationship with him. What did you think about some of the other bodybuilders? Because you were a bodybuilding fan. You know, you won Mr. Cincinnati when you were living out in Ohio. And then you come to Golds and you see these guys in real life. I've talked to a lot of bodybuilders who, when they first went to Golds, they were just blown away by seeing, you know, these people they read about in the magazines. What experience did you have when you went into the gym and you saw these other bodybuilders in person?
Well, I got to be honest with you, I wasn't necessarily in the same mold as, and I don't mean physically, but I was too busy with mm-hmm. other activities. You know, one, having to support the gym, but
right.
And I never worked in the gym. You know, that's why I wanted Waller to take over. But most of them weren't guys that I never looked at the magazines when I was back in Ohio.
So okay.
Most of these guys were new. Now, of course, they were sensational. You know, just everybody from Waller, Arnold, Grant, Franco, Zane, Draper. Mm-hmm. You know, they were all sensational. But most of them, it was just like me meeting anybody in the gym. We just chat, et cetera. A lot of horseplay.
Yeah.
It was a great environment. It wasn't, It wasn't anything phony. Everybody just sort of got along, but it was all the needling. It was almost like a middle school class, except guys with a lot of muscle.
Yeah, that's funny. I got into bodybuilding in the 70s, and, you know, it's so different now with the bigger gyms and everything's corporate-owned and everything. So,
It is. Yeah.
That had to be a great atmosphere back then.
Oh, it was. You know, we train a little bit, and train in the morning, head to the beach, and maybe train in the afternoon. And I'm giving you most of the guys that competed schedule. That's their schedule. Me, yeah. I tag along in the morning or the afternoon. And sometimes if I was really into training, you know, you get a bug every once in a while, then I'd be there with them training morning and afternoon. But the beach in the middle. But we'd all head up to the German restaurant, this little dive that was two blocks down the street. And we'd all eat there, and then the beach, and it was just a fun environment. You know, not many people had responsibilities. You have to keep in mind that most people at Gold's came from somewhere else. Some of them were fleeing other places, and some of them just wanted to get away from other places and come to California. Mm-hmm. And it had that allure. It had the allure of California, the sun, a gym. You know, it started to be known. You know, and here's another thing that might not make sense at first glance, but I had never heard of Gold's Gym until I got to California. Mm-hmm. Even though I'd, you know, been a pretty darn serious bodybuilder, I had never heard of the place. Like I say, it wasn't well known in the general media, and only a few times was it mentioned in bodybuilding publications.
Hmm. Were the magazines covering Gold's Gym? I mean, were they mentioning it more back then when you started owning it?
No, because I came out about the same time Weider came out. Once Weider came out, and then I put the arm on him. You know, like he'd want to take his shots, and Joe, I think, like any business guy, would be a little selfish wanting to keep everything for himself. Joe is a great guy. I really considered him a friend. Never once did he not follow through. You hear a lot about Joe Weider, but never once did he not follow through on what he promised, et cetera, with me. But anyway, Gold's wasn't mentioned much in the magazine. And then, we started getting the T-shirts. And because I was involved in the bodybuilding politics after a while, then I managed to wrangle Joe into making Gold's the exclusive location for his photography. After that point, you know, you open up Weider magazine and there was Gold's Gym.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I remember when I started bodybuilding. All the pictures were from Gold's.
Yeah. Yeah. Made a deal with Joe.
Now, what was interesting, Ken, was right after Pumping Iron stopped filming around the end of 75, you decided to move the location of the gym, right, to Santa Monica.
Yeah, and not so much that, well, let me put that into context.
Okay.
I was trying to get rid of the gym. I had lost interest, you know, I was just too busy, and my wife was not well, and I had lost interest in the gym. I wanted to take the gym building and turn it into a house. Which I did eventually. And so that was the reason that I moved the gym up to Santa Monica, the Second Street location, so I could go ahead and take that building and have this home reconstructed within it. And it was really a palace once I got it done. But the real funny thing there, I offered the gym to Waller. I said, Waller, you know, I wanted to keep him somewhat honest. I would not have felt right about closing the gym because where do the guys go, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I just would not have felt right about doing that. So I said, Waller, you give me $25,000 and the gym is yours, lock, stock, and barrel. You got to move it. And, you know, I could have sold it for a lot more. But again, Waller was a friend and he was in it from the beginning as far as with me. And he said, no, I don't think I want to own a gym. Then I was stuck with moving it. And I found this place in Santa Monica. And that happened to be coincidental to the time that the NPC and the AAU became one, essentially. Okay. The AAU had to reorganize because of the Olympic movement to allow each of the sports to have their own national governing body. Yeah, so the NPC was going to form, and coincidentally, I applied for a sanction to hold the Mr. California contest, the AAU Mr. California. Mm-hmm. I only did so because the new NPC chairman in California asked me to. He says, how about golds for a change, holding the show? And I said, oh, okay, I'll give you $1,000. Now, that sounds... $1,000 to hold the Mr. California contest. That was 10 times more than they'd ever been offered before.
Wow.
And so That's funny. Yeah, it is. It really is. And that left the weightlifting committee that usually got the contest all up in the air. That's when they called Gold's a professional gym, tried to block me from holding the contest. I wound up suing the national AAU, the local AAU, really brought them to their knees as far as litigation went. I held the Mr. California contest, and we had, again, the largest crowd for that. We filled up the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium, 3,000 seats, no trouble at all selling it. And the year before, for example, there were 500 spectators at the Mr. Cal.
Weightlifting Association.
That was the year, incidentally, that Cal Scalic won the Mr. Cal.
Over Dave Johns, he
was a Golds member, of course. Mm-hmm. And then he went on to win, after the Mr. Cal, went on to win the Mr. America.
Yeah. But
I got my competitive juices all wound up when they tried to block me from holding the contest. That's the only reason. Sounds silly in retrospect, but looking back and analyzing it, that's the only reason I got involved in the politics.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's the only reason. And then it went on, of course, to pretty much to control the NPC until I said, it's enough of this, and left.
And you had some experience in law school, right, Ken?
Oh, yeah. I went to law school while I owned Gold. I was so busy. That's why I really didn't get involved that much in the fact at all in the day-to-day operation of the gym.
Yeah.
I'd walk in just like anybody else that was a member and train and say hello to Waller, and that was pretty much my involvement until the contest started. And then I promoted those. Again, I had so many contacts in the motion picture industry, and it's all the same media in Los Angeles.
How big was the second Gold's Gym compared to the first one?
Well, the first, I can tell you exactly how big the first one was. It was 3,500 square feet.
Okay.
That included locker rooms and shower rooms, and then a downstairs first floor where the gym actually was, the equipment, which I would guess would be about 2,500 square feet. It was not a huge gym at all.
No.
Now but it made a nice big house. But the Second Street location, that was 7,500 square feet.
Okay.
So quite a bit bigger.
And, so three times the size, okay.
Yeah, three times the size, really. And then we had to fill it up with equipment, of course, but we also had a welding shop in the back to make our own equipment.
Okay.
You know, Gold's has this reputation of having great equipment at the time, but compared to equipment today, it was literally junk.
Really?
The only things we had that were different were the high cable pulley and a general pulley machine for, you know, all sorts of different exercises, and a long pull machine. Beyond that, that was it at first when I bought it. And those machines were all made by a guy in Oakland, a machine tool maker, who made all those machines. And out of some of them, the long pull machine was made out of an old Vic Tanny machine that he cut apart.
Wow. So did you notice an increase in the popularity of bodybuilding going into 1976 after they filmed Pumping Iron, or did it still take a while?
Yeah, no, I noticed it right then because, again, we were getting in mainstream media. That's really the key, especially when we hit 60 Minutes. At that time, 60 Minutes was, remember, there were only three networks at the time. That was before cable TV.
Yeah.
So to hit 60 Minutes, that was press agent's dream to get on 60 Minutes. It was a very flattering piece, and from Gold's perspective, at least, it really increased the awareness of bodybuilding. We'd have all kinds of people coming by the gym. You know, it was quite a deal. And of course, to promote the Mr. America contest, we had major American newspapers come out and do on-the-spot interviews for their hometown, like the Detroit Daily News, just give you a few of them, New York Times. They were all doing bylines from Gold's Gym prior to the Mr. America contest. It was all wow. part of building promotion. Japanese news crews came. National Geographic sent a crew.
Wow, so unbelievable.
Paul Harvey. Now, Paul Harvey was the most conservative radio personality of his time.
Yeah, I remember him.
He even covered it. So it was quite an extravaganza. And the day of the contest with the parade, we had 250,000 people lining the parade route to watch his bodybuilding parade. And then, of course, that night was the Mr. America contest.
Where'd you get the idea to do the parade, Ken? I thought that was a genius idea. You had bodybuilders in this parade on elephants and everything, and it was just, I never saw anything like it.
Yeah, well, you know, the key, oh, that was the key. There hadn't been anything like it, and I was looking for something that would be a crossover to the general population. Everybody likes a parade, but sure. No one had ever seen bodybuilders on elephants.
Right.
So that was the key. As a matter of fact, we had a parade that was about a mile long. It wasn't just a few bands and a few marching celebrities. It was a mile long, floats, bands. It seemed like every politician west of the Mississippi was there on horseback or something.
Right.
That year, it was the second largest parade, next only or behind only the Rose Parade in California.
Wow.
It was quite a deal. But that of course, that was the unique item. And the bottom line there, you've got to look for, or at least my concept was, the media is always looking for new product.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you can come up with something new to help promote whatever it is your product is, you're a step ahead.
Yeah. Was it hard negotiating with the city of Santa Monica? Right.
You know, it really wasn't. It of course, I guess you could call it sleight of hand, or maybe just a mistake on my part. But I got the parade permit. I had to go through the police department, of course, because they wanted to ensure that traffic and all would be taken care of. I convinced them, and I think I was convinced myself, that we'd only need 4 police officers. Well, the day of the parade, the Santa Monica Freeway, the exit to get to the parade had drawn so many people that the freeway was backed up several miles.
Wow.
To get off the freeway. And the police department had to call in the reserves from their Saturday time off.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it really was. But it was fun. It went really well. And it was sellout, of course. And there was a picture of Jack LaLanne. Oh, I had no idea, but he was on the outside running all around trying to get a ticket. Even Jack LaLanne couldn't get in.
That's hilarious. Where did you get the idea of getting Mae West to come?
Well, I knew she was an icon. She's a natural for bodybuilding because she used to have a show with bodybuilders.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
And she was promoting, I think it was Sextet. I think it was her last film.
Yeah.
I think Sextet was about to be released. And I thought, gosh, this would work for both of us. But again, she's old.
Yeah, and, she's like in her 80s, right?
Yeah, she was in her 80s. But it just took asking and letting her know that everything is going to be safe and all that. As a matter of fact, she got to the auditorium that night, and I thought, one of the guys really catered to her and had her dressing room all flowered up, I think a couple dozen. bouquets of flowers. And I thought, because I wasn't sure until the last minute that she would actually show up, even though I had promoted that she would be out there showing up. And it was in Variety and the Hollywood Reporter and on local media that Mae West was going to come out and give the trophy out, I still wasn't fully sure until she drove up in the limousine. And all she wanted, this is, I'll never forget this. From her dressing room, she sent a message. All she wanted, all she asked for, could she get some rubber glue for her false eyelashes? But anyway, when Dave Johns won the show, you know, he was announced, and here's this little old lady in a white suit. I had met her years before. You know, I had met her at a famous director's home. We had dinner together. And but this little old lady came sauntering out from side curtain on the arm of a companion of hers. And she looks at Dave Johns, and she was always a one-liner. She looks at Dave Johns, looks toward the audience, looks back at Dave Johns, and says, "He's got it all, and it's all in the right places."
She always said the right lines.
Yeah, and of course, having her there, that got it out on the AP wire and UPI.
Sure. Yeah.
Wire.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it, again, it's just all part of the promotion. The next year, I managed to get Stallone to come out and, for the Gold's Classic and hand out the trophy. But
right.
That was also a sort of inside job. He had hired Rudy Hermosillo as his bodyguard, as his gate man, actually. Called the gym. We sent Rudy. Rudy got the job as his gate man. Rudy, of course, bodybuilder. And Stallone says to me, "Well, if Rudy wins, I'll come out and hand out the trophy." Well,
Rudy's going to win.
I would say Rudy deserved to win, but had he not.
Yeah.
But anyway, Stallone came out, and again, promotion. That one made the wires. It Dick Clark did a piece on it when Dick Clark was very popular. He had his TV show, and
yeah.
You know, just continuing the promotion. And then right after that, I thought, you know, Marion died, my wife, and I thought, I'm out of it. I've remarried, and my current wife, now 40 years together.
Wow, congratulations.
She had no interest at all in bodybuilding. She thought it was nuts. And I thought, well, gosh, if I'm going to make a successful relationship here, bodybuilding's got to go.
Yeah.
So I sold out, sold the gym, and came back a little bit to help Pete, the new owner, Pete Grimkowski, secure the next year's Mr. America contest. But after that, I was pretty much out, you know,
okay.
Completely. As a matter of fact, I still train, and that wife of mine who said that she couldn't stand bodybuilding, she now loves to train.
Oh, really?
So, you know, things come around, go around, you know.
Yeah. Can you tell the price that you sold it to Pete Grimkowski and who was it, Ed Connors and Tim Kimball?
Connors,
right?
And a fellow named Denny Doyle was the third person.
Oh, Denny Doyle, okay.
And then Denny was replaced after a little while by Tim Kimber. Yeah, I'd be happy to. I kept a lot of the residual rights. And this is also worth context. You know, I felt the gym had been good to me. And I didn't pay anything for it, really. And I made an awful lot of money out of it. And I think I made $500,000, for example, the day of the Mr. America contest.
Wow.
But anyway, Marion really liked Pete. Pete was always extraordinarily nice to Marion. And I said, "Pete, $100,000, you take the gym, it's yours." I knew what I had because of someone had sued me just at that time. They heard I was getting out. And so someone sued me trying to, this sounds odd, it certainly did to me at the time, trying to force me to sell it to them for $1.5 million. And it was as much as anything a gift based on my liking and Marion's liking of Pete.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and two, Pete's done a wonderful job. I think they had to start selling franchises. I think Ed Connors was the first one, so that they could have a little more money into the gym. But yeah, that's the way things, you know, had I kept the gym, there would not be, you know, 600 Gold's gyms. There would be one Gold's gym.
Oh, really? You wouldn't have franchised?
Well, I would have never franchised it. No, I felt it was unique, and I would have kept it unique. And I would have kept it as just a special place to train. And that doesn't preclude being able to make money out of it, you know, because if you look now, you see Gold's Gym products in Walmart everywhere else.
Right.
And so I would have used that as a promotional vehicle, because promotion is what I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And you know, and without all the headaches of franchising, et cetera.
Now, wasn't it true that NBC offered you like $250,000 to promote the Mr. America every year, and then the AAU didn't want to do that? Because
You hit the nail on the head, which I thought was the stupidest thing. At the time, I know it sounds suspicious, but I was really trying to build bodybuilding for bodybuilding.
Right.
You know, I was getting my fair share, but not at the expense of bodybuilders. And I had negotiated a contract with NBC to have a yearly telecast of the Mr. America contest. Now, that would have set the Mr. America at the top of the heap forever, in my opinion.
Right.
There was just no way around. It was going to be a Saturday evening event. And Bert Sugarman was the producer's name that was going to take the line credit. A very famous producer at the time. In fact, you might remember this. They used to have a Saturday night wrestling like once a month on late night television. Anyway, he did that kind of stuff. But it worked out a deal. He had a deal that the AAU would get $250,000 every year for the rights to telecast the event. The only restriction, it had to be in Los Angeles every year.
Right.
Now, and the AAU or NPC thought, oh, no, we've got to move it around the country. They had no idea what the value was in having that thing on TV every year. I think everybody in the country that was a bodybuilder would have given their right arm,
at least
the right arm shot to be part of that deal.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, that would have been built up the popularity so much, especially at that time.
Exactly. But they, you know, they didn't have foresight. That's the way it crumbles. Yeah.
Yeah.
That wasn't me getting the $250,000. That was the AAU Physique Committee.
Right.
Oh, NPC. I use the AAU and NPC interchangeably.
Well, wow, talk about shooting themselves in the foot, huh?
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, when you did that 1978 Gold's Classic, that was one of the first pro shows. I just interviewed Robbie Robinson a couple of weeks ago. And you gave him a Cadillac Seville, right, as the winner of that contest.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. In fact, that was the biggest prize. That was bigger than the Olympia prize at the time.
Yeah.
By thousands. And let's see, at that Gold's Classic, the pro portion, yeah, Robbie won that. And we had Teenage America, and we had USA versus the world. I think it was three Europeans versus three Americans.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that was 6,500 fans at the Shrine Auditorium.
Wow.
You know, again, it's context. At the time, like $10 was a big ticket for a bodybuilding show. Mm-hmm. Now it's not.
Yeah.
But for the first 25 rows, you know, I had the ticket scaled at $50 a ticket. And those were the first to sell out, of course. I guess that's equivalent to 150 now. I can't extrapolate percentages exactly, but that would be equivalent to that now. But anyway, that was a big event. Ben Weider brought the vice president of Mexico to the event because Ben wanted to do a big deal in Mexico, and he knew this event would be one to knock his eyes out.
right. So, you know, I promoted a few contests in my time, Ken, and I agree with you, your concept of promotion, that was always important to me. I would always like try to invite the local papers or try to get it on the news, on the local TV, you know, before the event and stuff. So I sort of had the same ideas. So what was it that made your shows so big? Was it just the promotion of it beforehand? Because you were selling out, you know, these audiences in these huge theaters.
Yeah, it was the promotion. And again, Gold's became synonymous with bodybuilding. That was everybody around them. Well, I shouldn't say everybody, shouldn't be that presumptuous. Great number of people would flood Gold's in the summertime. They wanted to see this place, and as the magazines, as you can attest to, would have a Gold's Gym t-shirt on the guy training. Everybody from across the country or around the world would want to come and see this place. That was part of the appeal. And, of course, the local promotion. I think we had as many mainstream meaning non-bodybuilders, coming to the events as we would people that had even a little interest in bodybuilding.
Mm-hmm.
The bodybuilding crowd per se, you know, the number of competitors and built bring families and friends, etc., that was minuscule in compared to the promotion around this event. I always promoted it as an event, mm-hmm. you know, not an inside crowd sort of thing, but as a major event, like the parade, you know.
Yeah,
And, of course, it sort of took off on its own, in a sense, once the promotion got started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that promotion in the 70s is what made Gold's franchisable.
Yeah, absolutely. And then after the release of Pumping Iron in 1977, I'm sure.
Oh, sure. That was helpful. It all came together simultaneously, really, or close to simultaneous.
Yeah. You mentioned Cal Scalak a couple minutes ago, and he was always one of my favorite bodybuilders because he was just coming up when I got into bodybuilding. And not only did he have, I thought, a great physique, but he also had a real independent spirit where he just wanted to do things his way. And I remember he even like tried to form a union against the IFBB and sort of got shut down on that. And then he got out of the IFBB right after that. What were your thoughts about Cal when you met him?
Oh, you know, I like Cal. When I met Cal, he was living in his, he had a, like a bread truck. He drove out from the east, and he was parked in the Gold's parking lot, and he'd come in and train until Waller threw him out of the parking lot and made him park. Because we only had a few parking spaces. But I like Cal. As a matter of fact, I really pushed him for that Mr. California contest. Mm-hmm. I didn't fix it. This, I give you my word on, there was no fixing involved. He deserved to win it. But what I had to do, Dave Johns was expected to be the Mr. California that year. It was kind of a pecking order, the way things were. You were second one year, the next year you win, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I went, after the judges were assembled, I had no say in who judged. Ralph Countryman, who was a great guy, great, honest as the day is long, he selected the judges for it. But I did get the speak to them before the contest. And I didn't say vote for Cal. What I said is I want to read him the Riot Act. I don't want any gifts given to anybody. Of course, now that would say what? You don't give Dave Johns a gift because he's Dave Johns, because he's expected. And Cal was really nobody at the time. Nobody knew anything about this guy.
Yeah.
But marked from the unknown, just arrived from the East Coast, and he started training in the gym. So Cal won the Mr. California contest, went on 2 weeks later. Mr. Cal was always a stepping stone to Mr. America.
Right.
And he also won the Mr. America with a different panel of judges.
Right.
But, you know, it's funny how those things go. So the reputation got around. You have to be a member of Gold's in order to win a contest.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was involved in the politics, et cetera, national secretary of the NPC, and kind of the pulling strings behind the scenes in a lot of ways, but not as far as fixing contests.
Yeah.
But the reputation was there, you know, the myth. You got to be a member of Gold's. So who shows up the next year to start training at Gold's? Dave Johns.
Right. And then he wins the America the next year. Yeah.
Exactly. Dave Johns wins 77 America.
Right.
But we had so many guys there that were so good. I mean, I think for one stretch, we won every amateur and professional contest beyond like junior Mr. America, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
2 years, everyone. Over 40 Mr. America, teenage Mr. America, Mr. Olympia, Mr. USA, wow. As far as amateur there. It was quite a strain. And I guess it did get the seem you had to be a Gold's member to win anything. But it was based on the fact that everybody that started getting really good, they wanted to migrate to California to train at Gold's.
Right.
At 22.
Now, did you also promote the 78 America, the Tony Pearson one in Cincinnati?
I did. Tony arrived at Gold's, didn't have any money. Kent Keen really helped him out. Kent Keen would help feed him, et cetera, and I think he stayed with Kent for a few weeks. But he did win the 78 Mr. America. I promoted that in Cincinnati, the hometown again. Mm-hmm. And the way that all happened, Boyer Co. was the... We had intended that Boyer Co. hold the Mr. America, and I guess was Louisiana.
Yeah.
But we kept, because of the 77 America, we wanted the 78 to continue the tradition of a good show, a big-time show. And Boyer never contacted us. So we removed the show from Boyer, and I said, hey, I'll go ahead and put up the dough, and I have the contacts. We'll do it in the Midwest in Cincinnati. And so okay. We got it booked at this beautiful Cincinnati Music Hall, and it went great. In fact, Bill Pearl was the guest poser. That was the first thing he had done openly with the IFBB.
Oh, okay.
Guest poser at the 78 Mr. America in Cincinnati. I think now, there again, he would have, I think, done it free, but he got $1,500, if memory serves me correct.
Okay.
Of course, all expenses, always expenses. And there was controversy over that performance because some people, again, thought Tufel was, it's his turn to win.
Right.
Here's
I remember
Tony
that.
Out of nowhere winning. I felt mm-hmm. Tony was the best, personally. That's a sincere statement. I thought Tony was should have won.
Right.
I thought, now this is in the final pose down, I thought that Tom Platz should have beaten Tufel.
In the short class, yeah.
Exactly. I thought Tom Platz should have won, and then I'm not sure if I would have picked Tony or not. But as far as between Tufel and Manny was the tall class winner, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Manny
yep.
was another Gold's member and a good friend. So you just never know how these things are going to turn out. Again, I would have picked Platz, I think, over Tufel.
Yeah.
And had Platz been in the final post down, I might have leaned toward Platz. It's hard to say in retrospect because I never had to make that decision.
Yeah, because they did pick the Universe team right after the America was over, and then Platz did beat Tony in the middleweight class as they did in weight classes. So that was interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is. Tony's a great guy. I don't know if you've ever met Tony or spoken with him, but really a great guy. He lives in Las Vegas now, and like a lot of the guys, he's a personal trainer.
Mm-hmm. He's still in fabulous shape, too.
Great shape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you had Tony on the Good Morning America right after that show, continuing with your promotion of the show.
Oh, yeah. What I did there is I had it set up that the winner of the show would go fly with me the next day, and we'd be on Good Morning America on Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony was the winner. That was a funny thing in the show. Tony came on the set. I'm sitting there in a suit. And I played a straight guy. Tony's there with his Gold's Gym. There you go again, Gold's Gym t-shirt.
Right.
So we've got millions of people seeing a Gold's Gym t-shirt. But anyway, Tony's there, sweatpants, gold sweatpants, and Gold's Gym t-shirt. And I started talking about what bodybuilding's all about. And I says, Tony, go ahead and take your shirt off and hit a couple of shots. Now, I can't remember her name, but the interviewer, famous, but darn it, I can't remember her name. She was so awestruck. She had never seen anything like this. Tony has this big dimensional difference between no waist and a big lat spread.
Right.
That she dropped the microphone. It wasn't put on. If you ever go back and see that on TV, she just lost the microphone.
Yeah, I think that clip is somewhere on YouTube because I saw it not too long ago. I'll have to look it up again.
Yeah, look it up with that in mind. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just got all flabbergasted. It wasn't.
It really was a different time back then because we weren't used to seeing muscular bodies, especially in the mainstream. So
yeah.
it was like a brand new thing. Like, you know, like Charles Gaines said when he wrote the book, it was like we were discovering a whole new sport, a whole new continent, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, all those things together. I mean, the confluence of Golds and Pumping Iron and the general promotion around both, it really pumped up bodybuilding.
Ken, do you ever look at the sport now? Do you ever like see what's happening, like with all the different divisions and how the sport has grown and how the bodybuilders have gotten much bigger?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you who the Mr. Olympia is.
Yeah.
I don't follow it like that. I still go to the gym and train. But I have noticed that, oh gosh, there just seems to be a contest for everyone sort of approach. I would have kept it different. Even though I would have had one major championship, I would have not involved females. If females wanted their show, they would have the show. And I'm speaking from the standpoint, I produced with Lisa Lyon the first female bodybuilding championship that ever made TV. Mm-hmm. So I'm aware of bodybuilding, but I would have females in a sort of beauty contest, and I don't think I would associate it with bodybuilding. And again, okay. That's just personal point of view. I would keep it all male. No different. No, I think they're board shorts and stuff now. Is that right?
That's right. Sort of a,
yeah, I wouldn't have that. You've either got a full body or you don't.
Right. What about the size of the bodybuilders? Do you think it's sort of lost its aesthetic viewpoint or how the bodybuilders have changed over the years, from, the late 70s, early 80s to where it is now?
Oh, yeah. I think the aesthetic has gone. But again, it's certainly sensational. Some of these guys are so developed. That would have been unimaginable in the 70s.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And if that's, if that's the criteria, that's the criteria. But I do think the aesthetic is gone. I always thought two of the best were Frank Zane and Danny Padilla.
Mm-hmm.
Be hard for me to pick between. I'd probably pick Danny, but
yeah.
If your listeners know him, I thought he was probably the best. That includes Arnold, But
yeah, I always like to talk to people who were around back then and ask. Obviously, the sport has changed tremendously over the last 40 years,
As
all sports have. But I wonder if it's gone too far, if it's really progressed, or if it's in the right direction. And I always like to get the opinion of the people who were around back then.
Yeah, it's not the direction I would have wanted to see it go in.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I'm just, one person with one point of view. We're talking about the expansion of bodybuilding, and I mentioned females. One of the biggest decisions I had to make when I bought Gold's in 1972 was whether or not to allow the first female member in the gym.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, look at how things have changed now. Most of the guys didn't want to have any females in the gym.
Mm-hmm.
But once the first couple females started coming into the gym, no problems.
Yeah. Like I said, the atmosphere was so different back then in the gyms. And now, of course, they're open for everybody and they encourage everybody to come. But back then it was very exclusive. It seemed like a more hardcore. And I could
see why. And even the health clubs, they'd have male and female days.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, times have really changed in that regard.
Absolutely.
I was just thinking I would feel uncomfortable training in a modern bodybuilding gym, assuming there are. I would just feel uncomfortable, I think. I'd probably get used to it very quickly, but I think I'd be a little outside my comfort level.
Yeah, I don't think the hardcore ones are left. There's probably very few. They probably can't make any money, because the other ones are just...
Oh, you're limiting your clientele, yeah.
Yeah.
Even at that time, at that time, I don't think very many people wanted to lift weights for any reason. But
Right. Now, what was your relationship like with Joe Gold? Because obviously you knew Joe, because he tried to come back into the fitness world or into the gym world when he opened up World's Gym in the late 70s.
I did not like Joe Gold, candidly.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I've only spoken, Joe's passed, of course, but I have only spoken to him, had only spoken to him twice.
Mm-hmm.
Once when he came in the gym, he heard that I had offered Waller the gym, as long as it got out of my hair.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe tried to come in and grab it. And I said, no. He tried to lowball me. I think there was still a mortgage on the building at that time, which he originally built. But I said, none of that. And that just ticked me off with him. And then when he opened World Gym, that was a further reason for my dislike. be blunt, when he sold Gold's, he sold it with a non-competition clause. In other words, he could not open a gym within 10 miles of the original gym. So he started building a gym that was actually about a mile and a half away from the original gym after I moved facility to Santa Monica. He started building a gym, World Gym. So naturally, I waited till he was just about ready, because you have to show proof that you're about to be damaged. I went ahead and as far as legally. So I waited till he was just about finished with the building, equipment being moved in, and I hit him with an injunction. So he wasn't allowed to open the gym. At that time, he thought, well, maybe I can sell it to Franco, maybe Arnold, but you know, they didn't want a gym. So Judge got us together, and he told Joe, he says, you're not going to be able to open this gym. You know, it's a non-competition agreement which you signed. And the judge was going to enforce the agreement. I started feeling sorry for Joe. I thought, gosh, this older guy, he was older than me. Mm-hmm. But this older guy that he, you know, it's his name. He's got a name, Joe Gold, and he can't even use his name.
Right, right.
And I felt sorry for him. I thought, well, he wants a gym. And so I thought, okay, go ahead, open your gym. I can't remember. Naturally, I didn't let him do it for free. But I think it was, and when I say naturally, I was still ticked off, is what I'm really saying. Mm-hmm. I think he had to give me $25,000 plus, and this is what was significant. He was not allowed to have a picture taken in his gym for 5 years.
Wow.
So what that did for me was kept me with the noose around Joe Weider's neck.
Mm-hmm.
Joe couldn't, you know, use Joe Gold to get a softer position for me. So that it was really what, and again, that was the second, when we were in front of the judge, that was the second time that that I met Gold. But that was my total give and take with Joe Gold. I was ticked off. He still tried to manipulate, actually Muscle Digest. A fellow tried to open a start a new magazine called Muscle Digest.
Uh-huh.
And so he had heard about the agreement, couldn't take be on the premises to take pictures in World Gym. And so what the publisher of Muscle Digest did was had someone take a ladder to get look through the second story window.
I remember that, yeah.
And shoot photos through the window.
Right.
That lasted once because I sued him. I was litigious, obviously.
Yeah.
That's what it took at the time with the AAU and with Gold, and had people in Arizona and Timbuktu practically wanting to use the name Gold's Gym, and they'd open a gym, you know, their own little gym. Gold's had to shut it down. A lot of litigation here, there, but it was necessary to protect the name and the business. I wound up suing Arnold once because when Arnold went over to World Gym, because he and I were competitive in the same market, the same bodybuilding market. He saw that I started to promote professional shows. I didn't really care about professional shows. There was such a huge potential pool of competitors in amateur competition.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I went ahead and did the Gold's Classic with a pro element. And so Arnold started getting nervous. He goes over to World's Gym to try to take his celebrity there away from Gold's.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, Bobby Shriver, who would several years later become his brother-in-law, Maria's brother,
right,
younger brother, wrote a terrible article about Gold's in appeared on the front page of the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, which is was the second largest newspaper in Southern California. So I thought, oh, I can't prove anything here. You know, it would have just been so time-consuming to prove that Arnold was behind that.
Mm-hmm.
But then Arnold made a mistake. And I think it was People Magazine. He called Gold's Gym. I think he used the word outhouse. Now, okay. called Gold's Gym an outhouse. But what did that do for me? That gave me the standing to sue. for defamation, libel, actually.
Okay.
Published in People magazine. And so I wound up suing Arnold. I went to, in order to put pressure on him, I sued Arnold. I sued Golf and Western, which was the parent company of Paramount Pictures. I sued Paramount Pictures.
Wow.
And I sued a whole bunch of co-defendants, but really, it was put pressure on Arnold.
Yeah.
And so we were in a deposition one day. In fact, I sent a copy of that deposition to, I don't know if you know Joe Rourke or not.
Sure, yeah. The historian,
anyway,
yeah.
A copy of it to Joe Rourke. But the first deposition was of Artie Zeller. Joe Weider had already given me a an interview, on the record interview.
Okay.
Notarized interview saying, you know, that Arnold was just out to get me, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so I deposed Artie Zeller. Artie's a nervous wreck. He's just a nervous wreck during the deposition. He's never been in a deposition before.
Okay.
And my attorney's sitting there. And Artie, my attorney, asked a question. Now, you have to picture this. He had all these different attorneys from, like, Golf and Western, Paramount, Arnold, sitting around a table.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Artie being questioned. And my attorney asked Artie, in a straight face, now, is Arnold Schwarzenegger romantically interested in Ken Sprague? Oh, my God, you should have seen that room. The attorneys jumped up, objection, objection. now, of course Arnold wasn't. Arnold is as straight as an arrow.
Right.
But it was designed to say, look, Arnold, you keep playing games. This is where we're going.
It's going to get
Arnold. Arnold at the time was trying to build a movie career.
Right, right.
And at that time, you didn't want something like that being rumored.
Right, right.
So, especially not if your entree is muscles.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So anyway, you know, those are the kind of things you do.
Yeah, I remember that quote. I think he said,
Arnold never said a bad thing again.
Yeah, but I remember. I think he said going from golds to worlds is like going from the outhouse to the penthouse, right?
Yeah, something like that. Something
along. I remember that. I remember when that happened. Yeah.
I thought I got to calm this down.
Right.
I got Joe Gold under my thumb because of the no photos, etc. So, I wasn't going to let some other situation get out of hand.
Did that no photos ban last? Because I remember seeing pictures like when Arnold was training for the Olympia in 1980, they had photos in there.
Well, here's the deal. When Pete, I don't know why he did it, but when Pete bought the gym,
mm-hmm.
he relinquished Joe Gold from the contract.
Oh, okay.
Okay, gotcha. So what can you say?
Yeah.
It wasn't the smartest move, in my opinion, but it's all worked out. So.
Yeah, I think it's worked out for everybody, yeah.
That's right.
Well, Ken, I appreciate you taking all the time. I mean, you were at a seminal point in bodybuilding when it really changed in the golden age. So I appreciate you telling us all these stories about how it all happened with, buying golds from Bud and then expanding it and really making it popular. And I was really interested also to learn about those contest promotions you did because that 77 America really stands out for me because when you had that one of a kind, nobody's ever done anything like that before.
Oh, incidentally, what we charged the competitors at that time was $5.
Wow,
The most I ever charged a competitor was $10. And the only reason to do that was to keep some young fella in the Midwest that had no intention of ever coming to compete from sending mm-hmm. in an inform. Otherwise, it would have been free.
Wow. That's amazing. When you consider the prices today, that's crazy.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it's quite a deal. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Ken, thanks again for coming on the Bodybuilding Legend Show. I really appreciate your time, and I really appreciate your stories. Hopefully we can talk to you again sometime.
Sure. Thank you, John. Nice talking to you.
All right. Nice talking to you. Take care. All right. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I really want to thank Ken Sprague for taking the time to talk about his time as owner of Gold's Gym. That was a great interview. And I also want to thank Mark Martinez for helping set that up. Thanks to our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs, for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And on next week's show, we're going to have a really special show where we're going to talk to my friends Peter McGuff and Lonnie Tieper, two great experts in the field of bodybuilding. And we're going to talk about where bodybuilding, the look of bodybuilding, has been and where it is going. So this is going to be a really interesting conversation next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you then. Take care.